Hello and welcome to the fourth and final part of this series of podcasts focused on youth development in football in Australia. I'm Adam Peacock. My next guest is Alan Stadjic, coach of the Matildas, who are about to embark on a 9 months which may, hopefully, end in something great at next year's World Cup in France. In this episode, though, we're going to delve into how the Matildas ended up with such a great crop of players and what is being done to ensure that continues in the women's game. Because, as we know, it is one part of Australian football definitely going in the right direction right now.
Oh, Sam Kerr! Wow! Sam Kerr! It looked ominous the way it was coming across her body. And boy, did she hit it sweet! It's one of her best goals ever for her country.
Alan, thanks for your time today. Ordinarily, we'd sit here and say how good a coach you are and how good the Matildas are going at the moment, but this is a little more detail, a little bit more background about things. You okay with that?
Yeah, I'm good.
Yeah,
I'm good. I'd like to talk about myself. No, I actually wouldn't.
I suppose it is about how we ended up with a group of players like this. It wasn't a fluke. Well, I hope it's not a fluke. I hope you're not going to just sit here and say it's a fluke because there goes the next 50 minutes or so. But you look at the Matildas right now, and this is basically along the path of youth development, but they end up somewhere. And the group of, in particular, 23 to 27-year-olds you've got amongst the elite Matildas right now is something quite special and something we're all proud of, and no doubt you love coaching them. But what I want to know
sometimes.
How we got to this point with these players, and was there something that happened 10 years ago that is something that stands out in your eyes?
Yeah, look, this is obviously, we have a lot of bus trips on our away visits, and something that Gary and I and Luke Casley and all that reflect upon, you know, for hours and hours, and, you know, every single bus trip there's an hour worth of discussion about how we got here in terms of the Matildas and how we got here in terms of the Socceroos. And obviously there's been a lot of reflection on what happened in the transition from the old National League to the A-League. You know, we don't just talk about the girls' pathway. We obviously reflect upon the differences and similarities between what's happened in the girls' pathway and the boys' pathway over that period of time. And when we look back at the transition from the old National League to the new A-League, there were obviously a lot of factors that had an impact on the boys' side of the pathway. Not having a National League for a couple of years, the NYL not being in place for a few more years, a shortened NYL. You know, Luke and I have often reflected upon when I was a boy, when we were youngsters, we had a National Youth League where there were 16 teams in a Northern Division, which spanned across Sydney and a little bit of Brisbane later on. Mm. Most National League teams had an A youth team and a Colts team. The AIS were involved in that competition as well. And then there were 16 teams in Melbourne. So there were 32 teams across pretty much the main centres of Australia covering National Youth League from 15 to 20. So there was a massive part of that pyramid in the pathway where boys could come up and play. And I was just talking about yesterday, my first game in the NYL, we were talking about Zlatko Nastevsky and, you know, how he was a freak and possibly one of the greatest goal scorers we've had in Australia and imports we've had in this country. And he was probably one of my idols growing up as a 12, 13, 14-year-old going to watch Marconi play every weekend. And my first game in the NYL, he was coming back from a knee reconstruction. I had to mark Zlatko Nastevsky. So that's gone. That sort of disappeared for a long time from our pathway. And the kids of this generation haven't had those same opportunities that we had in the 80s and 90s and even the early noughties that I think was a big part of the past, big part of the jigsaw puzzle that produced our golden generation of Socceroos. And I don't think 2006 was our golden generation. I think that spanned from the late 90s. Mm. Yeah, we lost against Iran and Uruguay, but those players in those teams were also, for me, part of that golden generation of Socceroos. And that evolved over that whole period of time due to the pathway that we had in place. Now, that disappeared for the boys, and I think as a result, usually you see the consequences 8 to 10 years later, and I think we're in that period now. Mm. For the girls, we had a different pathway that was established post-Sydney Olympics, and it was one that was based around the institute system. So Soccer Australia or whatever their name was at that particular point in time didn't even look after the women's side of the game. It was their own independent association. But most of the development due to the Sydney Olympics happened within the institute system, state federation. So New South Wales Institute of Sport, Queensland Academy of Sport, Victorian Institute of Sport, I'd go around the whole country and name all the institutes, they all had a female program in place. And those institutes are geared more towards elite sport than possibly even our A-League clubs are now.
Mm.
So they've got resources like psychologists, nutritionists, sports science, all the cutting-edge things that are involved in producing Olympic athletes and the Olympic and world champions that we've had in every sport. And that was in place to support our women's footballers for a long time, up until 2012. And, you know, there was, you know, I've been talking for a long time to people internally about how big a blow that was to our sport. And even at the time as it was happening, I was saying we have to do everything we possibly can to replicate that environment. Otherwise, we'll be in the same situation the Socceroos are in 10 years' time.
What happened in 2012?
Pretty much the institutes, you know, they thought that football was becoming more independent and they didn't need to support football anymore as a professional code. So most of the institutes around the country pulled their support from football, and football wasn't one of their sports that they chose because they get to choose their sports for a four-year cycle. And that meant that the programs went back to member federations because the A-League clubs and W-League clubs weren't geared for development and certainly weren't geared for 12 months around the clock training and competition. So our players were playing W-League, got 3 to 4 months of competition, but in the other 8 to 9 months, players had to go back to NPL level, and the levels at NPL level are probably not good enough to produce our best international players. You know, there's some NPL clubs around the country that have certainly evolved and are trying hard, and especially in the last 2 or 3 years have improved greatly, and the amount of resources and care put to them, put towards the women's side of the game has been increased, and the investment, but it's still a long way behind what we require to be able to compete with Japan, North Korea, China, just in Asia, let alone Germany, France, England, America, and all the big countries in the world. So there's a lot of things that we have in place that are functioning well in the women's side of the pathway, but the institute structure that we had was certainly, for me, the major platform and foundation that helped produce this you know, so-called golden generation. I hate that term, by the way. I hate golden generation.
Well, if you win the World Cup, we're going to call it the golden generation. Okay?
I know you will, but I don't like it for a couple of reasons. One, we haven't won anything yet. And the second reason is exactly what we're talking about. That means that at one particular point in time, we had the capacity to produce players and we can never do it again.
Yeah.
And that, for me, grinds on me. Like, why could we have that special pool of Socceroos around that 10, 12-year era, and now similar for the Matildas? Why can't it be ongoing? We need to be a country that has a system in place that produces players all the time, forever. And when we look at countries like France and Spain, they have the odd dip in terms of World Cup performances, but the players coming through the pipeline are always there. Mm. When you look at Croatia, for example, players are always coming out of Croatia. You know, I know they're the hot topic because they made the World Cup final, but players have been coming out of Croatia for the last 20, 30 years and playing at the top levels. And if a country of 4 million people can do it, if big countries like Spain and France can do it, if countries like Iceland can do it with 300,000 people and compete against England and Portugal and Holland and eliminate countries like Holland from European championships and World Cups, then there's no reason why a country as wealthy and smart and as innovative as Australia can't do it and can't do it forever.
So before we get to more about what happened with the current Matildas and your thoughts in a more general sense in a moment, so what's happening right now then? If that institute program went away for the girls in 2012, has it come back in some capacity? And how long was the gap in between it coming back?
Yeah, I call that gap the black hole. Yeah. We've had a black hole, and it was, you know, I was only a small-time institute and Sydney FC coach at the time, and I remember talking to the powers that be about the potential dangers of what's coming, you know, just going back. Our state federations do a really good job. Mm. They try their hardest to put in programs that aim to produce the best players we can have for W League and for national teams. But at the end of the day, they are not professionally geared to develop footballers.
Yeah.
It's a member federation.
They administer football. They don't develop.
Of course, and they're trying their hardest. They don't do anything wrong. But a professional environment requires all those extra resources, quality coaching, quality training, quality competition, and all those support mechanisms that go to help a player. And if you don't have all those things in place, then you're at risk of not being world-class and cutting-edge, and then you're also at risk of not being able to produce the best players. And again, it goes back to what we had and then what we were missing. So during that period from 2012 till now, a lot of people just thought my words were empty, but last year our under-17s team played against Japan and North Korea for World Cup qualifiers. Mind you, we've never qualified in the under-17s Women's World Cup, and it's been going since 2008 biannually. We lost 5-0 to Japan and 7-0 to North Korea. And I think it finally hit home that we do have a problem with our development system when we're being beaten by that bigger score at that level. And similarly, the young Matildas...
That was our first kind of step into the black hole.
And our young Matildas haven't qualified since 2006. So again, it shows that our youth players aren't coming out of that pathway at a sufficient level to be able to compete with the best countries in Asia, which happen to be the best countries in the world as well at that level, but we are nowhere near it at the moment.
So has it come back, this institute?
Well, as you know, we put in this Future Matildas program this year, yeah, which aims to replicate a little bit of what we had, but I think we've done even a better job than replicate. We've made the program better. We have Gary Van Egmond, who's there full-time. We had Leah Blaney, who's there full-time. We've imported players from around the country in a homestay type environment where they all come now and train together and play together and evolve and grow together for 6 months a year.
It's essentially like the old AIS program for the boys down in Canberra, which had Viduka and all those guys come
through. But better. And I'll tell you why it's better for a couple of reasons. It's very similar, and I have to say that was at the forefront of my mind when we were putting it together, having that AIS model. But we're based in Sydney, not Canberra, where we can get much better access to good-level competition. We can play against a good level of boys here, whether it's Sydney FC boys, Wanderers, a Blackdown City, a Marconi.
Just don't publicise it.
But I'm not worried about that stuff. That's really just, you know, people who are keyboard warriors can say whatever they want. But at the end of the day, we need to play levels, and you need to find a competition level that's going to push and stretch yourself. So it doesn't matter whether that's a boys' team,
yeah,
or a girls' team. We've had the flatline structure here in New South Wales for a couple of years now, and there's been scores like 8-0 and 10-0 and 12-0, and that doesn't do anyone any good. Doesn't do the good boys any good, and it doesn't do the boys who are getting flogged 10-12-0 any good either. So we've got to find a competition level that's going to push players out of their comfort zone, and that's what we've done. They've also played in the women's NPL, and already within 1 year, there's three or four players who have come out of this program, like Mary Fowler, like Amy Sayer, like Alex Chidiak, like Jada Wyman, who are already, and Princess Ibeni as well, who were sort of a little bit up and down, a little bit inconsistent. Yeah, they had the potential to get to Matilda's level, but they've already progressed to a point within 6 months of full-time professional training to get to the point where I'm comfortable in picking them for the Matildas and knowing that they can do a job for us. And another reason why it's better, not just the location, it's now also a daily training environment for our Matildas. So people like Chloe Legazo and Larissa Crummer and any other player actually come in and train daily with these players, or we fly them interstate every Wednesday night for this game. So the young players are getting the experience of having these players by their side, and they get to train with them. And that didn't happen in the old day. There wasn't ex-Socceroos that you'd go down and train with a young Viduka or a young Aloisi or Oshkoko or whoever. So that's why this program is so good, and that's why we've seen such good early results from it. And I know that they'll continue into the future.
So how old are these girls that are in this program, 16, 17?
We've targeted it from 15 to 20, and it's called the Future Matildas program, not the Young Matildas program. And it's a small but important distinction.
And how many in the group, sorry?
We targeted a maximum of 20.
Yep.
But our aim is to replicate this program around the country and have hubs around the country. And, you know, we've got a new TD coming into FFA, so hopefully this will be part of the remit of trying to establish. We've got NTC programs, but I just think they need to have a lot more vigour. There needs to be a lot more accountability. For example, there's plenty of capital cities in Australia on the women's side that haven't produced a Matilda in 5, 6, even 10 years. So we have these NTC programs in place, but if you haven't produced a player in 5 years, 6 years, 10 years, what are you doing?
What's the point?
Like, what's the point? Mm. What's the point of funding? Those players may as well just go back and play in decentralised fashion, because they're actually not producing what we want you to produce, which is an elite footballer who's going to represent our country.
How are you going to get the coin for this?
Look, a lot of those programs are already funded. The Future Matildas program, we're very fortunate that the New South Wales Institute of Sport, who are an arm of the New South Wales government, as we know, have come back to the table and offered some financial support, but also some structural support to the program.
Yep.
So we're very fortunate that they're an important partner. We also had Westfield Sports High School as an important partner in the program. So these are the kinds of things that we put in place to support the players both on the field and off the field to ensure, you know, not just the football development, the development off the field, and, you know, we use the word holistic, but really these players got everything they need to develop as people, to develop as footballers, and to think about all the different elements, you know, in football and away from football to help them throughout their life.
Are we worried about what's going to happen to the Matildas given this little five-year window black hole that you described, that in 10 years, unless Sam Kerr's still playing when she's, what, 35, and Lisa Devanna's playing when she's still, what, 52, which is a chance. I'm not ruling that out by any stretch of the imagination. I dare say that Lisa Devanna's not ruling it out.
Who knows with Lisa, but, yeah, it's all, everything's on the table.
Are we fearful that there's going to be a dip at the elite level, or is it have you maybe not papered over, but, you know, made up for what happened with what's going on right now?
Yeah, I think the Matildas have had an interesting history, and you have to sort of look back a little bit to see why these players, you know, obviously we had the foundation point was the old institute structure and the coaches that we had around the country. We had some excellent coaches who were involved in the talent ID at the time, and, you know, I spoke about the structure, but the coaches were also very important. When Alistair Edwards was in Perth, all of a sudden we had some Perth players come through, and Sam Kerr was one of those. When Ross Aloisi was in Adelaide, we had six or seven good players come in from that area, which we've never had before, and Alex Chidiak was one of those.
Yep.
So wherever we've had good coaches, we had Mark Jones back in the early 2000s at Newcastle, we had Mike Mulvey and Jeff Hopkins in Brisbane. Whenever we've had good people on top of this good foundation, we've managed to find good players. But in terms of the black hole, I think this Future Matildas program has definitely minimised the harm within the hole. It's still there. I still don't think the capacity of these 15 to 20-year-olds is what the capacity is and the capabilities are of that 23 to 27-year-old age group. And in that age group, we've got Sam Kerr, Alana Kennedy, Steph Catley, Caitlin Ford. You know, I could go on and on. Mm. Basically three-quarters of our Matildas. But in the past, you know, most of the Matildas, by the time they got to 25, 26, 27, had to retire.
Mm.
It just wasn't financially sustainable. You know, you could not live a normal life and stay in the Matildas. And it was a case of the longer you stayed in the team, the more harmful it was to your life, you know, post-football, because obviously the financial rewards weren't there.
Not
so
now.
Now this team is now the first team in history that's evolved from semi-pro to fully professional. I really believe that our top, I'll say 15, maybe even I'll stretch it out to 20 players are now fully professional footballers.
Mm.
So hopefully we won't get this vicious cycle now where players retire at 25, 26, and then we have to pick 15, 16-year-olds to replace them, which is the cycle that was happening again and again and again. But when we look back, all these players who are now 24, 25, 26, they're all between 60 and 90 caps, maybe even 100 caps for our country. And yet they're still young.
Yeah.
And that's why they are such an important group in our landscape. So now our main objectives now are to ensure that we maintain that level by drip-feeding talent through all the time in the bottom end, coming through as young players, and then at the top end to make sure that we look after the players, as we have done, as the PFA and FFA have really, you know, they have to be congratulated, both organisations, on the way that they've evolved the player payment structures and the support structures for female players, because it's come a long way. There's obviously always things that we'll want to improve, and the players will always ask for more things that they're entitled to and should be getting, and they should be. But it's certainly come a long way in the last 2-3 years.
Is AFLW or another sport out there going to drain your player pool coming through?
Yeah, it could, definitely. There's certainly potential of that, but like in football, we always want competition. We don't want to be a sport where we're competing against two countries and call ourselves world champions like some others. You want good competition, and I think that internal competition has certainly driven a lot of those organisations.
Mm.
I think the AFL have seen the power of women's cricket and women's football and rugby sevens and netball, and said we need to have a comp. The NRL have just jumped on board this year as well. I think all these organisations are driving each other to ensure that they've got a good, stable competition support base and mechanism that's going to grow their game. And I think they're all a bit late to the party, to be honest. I think the fact that none of these sports, you know, and football's probably been in the game a little bit longer than some of these others, haven't had viable competitions and environments for young girls to play in is really the tragedy. Like, I've got a young daughter now, and for me, for her to grow up in an environment where she has a choice and where she has female role models to look up to, if she wants to, is a massive change environment to the environment 20 years ago, where these current Matildas grew up and they couldn't name a female player.
Mm.
Their heroes were Beckham or Michael Owen or Maradona or whoever, because there was never any females to look up to. And, you know, I think the snapshot of that young girl opening that Sam Kerr jersey is a good little is a good little metaphor for the current landscape. So young kids who are now growing up, young boys and young girls will now be familiar with international players in whichever sport, and Elise Perry or whoever in netball or rugby or football that they can aspire to become, and feel that, you know, them playing sport is something that's normal and encouraged, and something that, that should be part of the Australian landscape.
Back before they become elite, and even before they realise that they've got a chance to become elite, what for you makes a young footballer, both male and female, if there is a distinction between the two, say when they're the discovery phase and the skill acquisition phase, if you want to use the proper terminology out of the curriculum, up to, say, 12 years of age?
The one thing I have probably learnt, the older I've got, is that you actually can't tell. Actually can't tell at that age who is going to make it as an elite footballer. We can all see a group of kids playing and thinking, yeah, that kid's got something special, or that kid's a little bit better than the others, that kid's a little bit tougher, stronger, quicker, more skillful, whatever the case may be. But at the end of the day, the correlation between who's good at 8 and 10 and 12 and 22 is minimal. Mm. You know, it's less than 1%. And even in boys' football, I would say up until the age of 16 or 17, there's still a small correlation between the best 16, 17-year-olds in our country and the ones who end up being good Socceroos. In girls, I'd probably say probably up to the age of 12 or 13, there's little correlation. Probably by 15, I think there's a bigger correlation. But I think...
Why is there a difference?
Well, just because of the early development. You know, females develop at a much earlier age, and the power factor is not as great. So they don't have as much testosterone, obviously. So the power differentials between a 13-year-old girl and a 16-year-old girl are nowhere near as big as they are in boys' football.
Yep.
In boys' football, you see every age group, 13 to 14, they're so much quicker, 15 so much quicker, 16 so much quicker, whereas in girls, you just don't have that power differential. By the time they're 14, 15... they're almost as strong and quick as powerful as an adult female in most cases.
Do you find that the best young female footballers, and I'm trying, this is in by no means a question down the path of sexism or whatever, but I've noticed a couple of, in the area that I live in, a couple of the female, elite, good young female footballers have had older brothers. Is that a accident, or is it just something that I've perceived and I've got wrong?
It'd be interesting. It'd be interesting to do a study, but obviously there's been studies in the past about where good players come from. You know, and there was all those studies in England about that table tennis. Was it Matthew Syed, I think his name was, about how, you know, that table tennis crew evolved because they had a good coach at that time in that environment. They all competed against each other.
Four or five of them, yeah.
Of course. And I think you're touching on the same point. I think the majority of players in our Matildas are either the youngest in the family, they had older brothers, or twins.
Got something to prove.
We've got a lot of twins in our group as well.
Oh, really?
So you can obviously see that environmental factor of competitiveness is an essential part, and being the youngest sibling in a family, I know what that's like. You never want to lose, do you?
I've noticed that with my youngest as well. She's a hurricane of intent.
And that's just natural environment, isn't it? And that's going to happen in every sport all the time, but it doesn't mean that that's a golden rule. It just means that those environments are possibly more conducive to promoting that competitive, intrinsic motivation within that person. But that doesn't mean that all the players are going to come out of that environment. It just means what probably the predominant factor is.
This is the eighth sit-down I've had with someone involved in the football industry about youth development, and there's different...
Is it getting better or...?
I'm not sure. There might not be a ninth. It's all up to you. there's all different points of view, and I've tried to touch on as many areas as possible, i.e. the old elite system. Talk to Ron Smith, talk to Ian Crook, who's involved in the academy system with boys. This time around, talk to Rob Sherman, who's involved with coach education or has been involved with coach education. Talk to Tom Beyer, who is a big proponent, whether you like him or not, of give a two-year-old a ball and start figuring it out there. What do you see as the most critical point of a footballer's development? Does it start when they can barely walk and they set their eyes on a football for the very first time?
Look, they're all fantastic people you just mentioned, by the way. They're probably some of the best people we've had in our landscape. I know Tom's from overseas, but Rob and Crookie and people like that have had fantastic impact on our coaching structures and on our young players, whether at Wanderers or, you know, Crookie was at N-Swiss for a long time as well. But I certainly think... Harmberger put in a lot of good things in place in FFA in terms of the curriculum and the structures of the age groups and the progressions of learning and things like that. The one thing that I think that, you know, I think in his time he's probably left the biggest legacy in terms of a TD, but the one thing I think we strayed from too far was individual skill development.
Mm.
And we started focusing on too early on shape and style of play. And when you talk about the skill acquisition or the game training period, that 13 to 17, that for me is still skill acquisition. It's still skill acquisition now for my Matildas. And obviously you're not spending 90% of your time on skill acquisition like you might in a younger age group, but there's always skills to be acquired. And that's where I'm more down the Tom Beyer end of things. I certainly think that ball mastery and the old Curver programs that we had here in Australia have also been important in a couple of the Matildas that we have. But Westfield Sports High School, where they got to do a lot of repetition, I was at Hill Sports High School. Again, a third of our Matildas came out of Westfields or Hills.
Mm.
Simply because these players had more sessions, more touches on the ball, more competitive environment. And ultimately, they're our better technicians in our team. And then obviously we've got Emily Van Egmond, who has her father and grew up in that environment as well, where she had multiple touches on the ball and a father who encouraged her to work on her individual skill development. So they're all the factors I think that are important at the young ages. And I really think our SAP programs at the moment, I was sceptical originally, I have to say, but I really think our SAP programs are delivering a good quality technical base for most of our players. Having seen a lot of the 12 and 13-year-old boys over the last year or so, the quality of young players coming through is astronomical. We really, really have done a good job in that SAP space. And now the essential part is what we do with these young players from 13 to 17 and then obviously 17 and above and ensure that they've got opportunities to play at a high level and develop at a high level, you know, and have the capacity to have competitions and structures in place where everyone has an opportunity to develop.
Heard a story, you can deny it if you want or confirm it if you want and expand on it, that you noticed a talented 12-year-old, I think she was 12 at the time, 12-year-old girl, and you might do this multiple times, so I might not be able to exactly say when it happened, but you saw a talented 12-year-old girl and you went, you should be training with boys as much as possible. Do you do that often or do you remember the case?
Yeah, there is a case that happened recently, yeah. There's a young player up in Manly, I won't mention her name, but she was in a boys program and then she'd moved to a girls program for a year and I saw her play at a state championships and I asked her what her background was. Obviously, she had older brothers, as you mentioned before. Older brothers were playing at Sydney FC as well, so they were talented older brothers on top of that. And then she went back and played with the girls for a year and I'd asked her, how did she feel about that? She goes, yeah, it wasn't as tough, wasn't as challenging. And I said, well, you need to be in an environment that's tough and challenging and it's going to push you. And you said training with boys. And I don't mean training with boys as in that's, the magic bullet. That's all of a sudden the solution. The solution is to train in the hardest, toughest environment with the best coach you can, one that's really going to push you out of your comfort zone in terms of the quality of your technique that you must have, the quality of tactical awareness that you must have, the decision-making and all the elements around developing you as an individual footballer. And it still goes back to individual skill development.
Mm.
Your first touch, your ability to dribble, to beat people, to use your body, to shield the ball, to head the ball, to volley, all the things that are exceptionally important once you get to that elite level. And how many times do we lament the fact of our Aussie players not being able to execute a skill in elite football? Well, that starts at the lower ages. And really that individual skill development is, for me, the most important factor, whether you're 12 or 13 or even 17 or 18.
You must care a lot about what's coming through then for that, because there's not a lot of national team bosses that would go out and what were you there anyway?
Yeah, I was partly there by fluke. But again, looking back, I do recall seeing all our Matildas playing at that age. I remember Sammy Kerr when she was 13 at a national titles. I remember seeing Caitlin Ford for the first time as a 12-year-old, Kai Simon as a 13-year-old. So I do remember the first time I saw all those players. And you asked, do you see something special? And
yeah,
and probably I did at that time. You know, they had that extra bit of... I remember Caitlin Ford was playing against 17, 18-year-old girls at the time and just beating people for fun, you know, 1v1 dribbling and stepovers and cuts and the speed and the tenacity to want to beat people, yet she was 2 foot tall playing against six foot people. And having seen those little qualities always, you know, sort of endear me to that player. And then obviously I kept track of her for a couple of years, but they're probably the qualities you look for. It doesn't still mean that it's going to correlate to elite adult performance.
That's what I was going to say, actually. Can you see all the the first impression sights that you saw on those occasions with those players that you just mentioned still now when you're standing there sweating your you-know-what's off in the middle of America watching a Nations Cup when they're playing against Brazil, for instance?
Yeah, well, I think everyone can see those qualities now. You can see the qualities that Sam Kerr had, she had them when she was 13. The difference now is Sam can replicate those same behaviours game in, game out, and that's probably only happened in the last 2 years, 3 years. She's really matured a lot on and off the pitch. She's really developed that sense of wanting to learn the art of football. I think she's one of those players who played with a lot of X factor and freedom, and she still does. Mm. The ability to find space and move, and she's an unbelievable athlete in terms of mobility and change of direction and reading the flight of a ball. She really has all Tim Cahill-like qualities in terms of reading the play and reading what's going to happen. But she really has immersed herself in trying to learn and execute and perfect her skills. And that's led to the consistency now where she can replicate these skills game in, game out. And yes, I do see it in all those players. You see Kai Simon playing. She still has the same left foot, right foot, the awareness of the game, the decision-making, the skill that she developed in young Curva programs and Caitlin Ford. And as I said, I could rifle through the whole team. You still see those qualities. And as adults and as senior players, you hope that they're still working on their game because, as we said, they're still 23, 24. If they can peak at 27, 28, even 30 to 32, then we really will have a team that's going to have long, sustained success, which is what we want.
Been an explosion in girls' football, and they've got the greatest bunch of role models you could hope for in terms of a footballing sense. You turn on the television, you watch the Matildas play, you want to play like them. There's no way you need to sugarcoat anything. There's no way you need to convince anyone of anything in terms of how they play. I know you'd have little doubts about little things that they do during the game, but for the kid watching the game, they go, wow, how good's this?
And that should come in our video session.
So for the girls watching that it wants them to get better as footballers, and there has been an explosion in the numbers of girls playing football. Have we got the capabilities to harness that into something that's going to be sustainable over 50 years, for instance?
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. And again, the three things you need are you need good players, you need a good environment, competition environment, and you need good coaches. So if we put those three things in place, then with all the support networks around them, then we will keep producing players because Australia is, for some, I still can't really put my finger on it as to the reason why we are still such a determined and aspirational country. When you look at how cultures have evolved and how different countries play football, everyone's got their distinct style. Mm. But Australians are still so aggressive and strong-willed and
I have a theory.
And really, when you look at our characteristics, they more replicate a third-world country.
Because we're so far removed from everyone else, we've got a bit of a chip on our shoulder as to say that, yeah, okay, we're so far removed from you, but we'll still try and beat you. I'm not saying this about all of us, but there is that fact that we were convicts once upon a time, or some of us anyway. So there's that edge to our society that wants to prove people wrong and has a bit of, for want of a better word, bulldog about them, if you know what I mean. So there is that inner fire that's hard to distinguish, and it's a hard place to live because it's so damn hot in summer as well in some places.
Definitely, and that hunger is something that's important. And when you have that, all those qualities that we talked about, and you talked about the history of Australia, I think on top of that, especially in football, men's football, probably more than women's football, the first generation Aussies, again, having to prove themselves, having came out here with nothing and then wanting to grow up in a new country and trying to find their way and have those innate hunger qualities that you spoke about. But to have that in a wealthy country with the resources we have compared to other countries, there's no reason we can't have 50 years of sustained success if we have good programs, plans and supporting environments around.
Fingers crossed. How long are you going to be around for those 50 years?
I doubt unless they've developed that gene that lets you live a lot longer. Look, I'm really proud of where we've got to as a country in terms of women's football. I've been involved for 20 years now, and to see the point that we've got to, it was always the point that you dreamed about and wanted to get to, but maybe it was that, you know, that dream that you just can't get to. But having seen where we've got to in terms of being able to beat America, in terms of competing with the best nations on earth, in terms of getting a sellout crowd at a major venue on the same day that NRL finals were on and AFL finals were on in the same city, it really has gotten to the point where I think you know, we really have proven that the niche market of women's football is a lot bigger than people ever thought it was, and it needs a lot more credit and support than what we've ever given it in the past.
Getting a little off topic here, but can you see yourself being involved in that, or maybe a technical director role, or going to men's football in the future, or
yeah, I don't
whatever?
Know. I don't know. I've got a big enough job for the short term, worrying about this current crop. They're a great bunch of players to work with, but as we know, it's very demanding, and we've got a big couple of years ahead of us, and all my thoughts and energies are focused on that and ensuring we have the best possible chance to do as well as we can at the next World Cup and Olympics, and worrying about all that other stuff's a bit of wasted energy.
Fair enough. Damn, I didn't get a headline out of it. Spew on. Just one last one. You mentioned before about the three pillars. You mentioned about coaches, enough coaches. There is a little bit of a fear that the coach education, it's hard to get that message out there across the board, across all the layers of football. How do you see that landscape at the moment?
Yeah, I probably agree with that. You know, as I said, we've got a new TD coming into FFA shortly, hopefully in the next couple of months, and that's an important area we have to address. And having quality coaches, without question, is something. When I look back and mention an example that I mentioned before, when I look at Iceland, the one thing they did was provide facilities for every young player to play after school. There was a synthetic pitch built in every town. So every young boy and girl in the country could go and play football after school, and every coach is qualified. They've got the highest per capita rate of qualified coaches in the world.
Easy to do in a... That's like doing it in Wollongong.
It's easy to do in Australia as well.
Yeah.
We can do whatever we want if we put our minds to it, and we can find solutions that suit our country. And we've had some good foreign TDs who have imparted a lot of knowledge, but I think it's time that we find the best person for our environment that's going to use the wisdom of the world, but find solutions that are going to work for Australians.
And get heaps of money out of the government to build these places as well. Fingers crossed.
We're getting there.
Staj, thank you so much for joining us. Learned a bit, as always. And, hopefully there is that ninth episode after this eighth episode of the Youth Development Podcast.
That'd be good. I look forward to it.
Cheers, mate.